This is going to be a shorter talk than the earlier one. I was thinking of what I could put into DMF tuning notes as such, which is not in the documentation, because my first suggestion would be read the manual. I picked up on a couple of points that I'm going to present in a few slides. One of them is a fairly generic point about storage tuning, and the other one is something about tapes. And we have had a lot of discussion and a lot of comments about how the tapes are getting over-exercised in a production DMF environment because of the way file recalls happen. And I got a couple of suggestions on what the system admin can do rather than how to change user behavior. There are a couple of tricks within DMF. Okay, so here goes. The first thing I want to talk about is XVM volume tuning. The performance of the DMF server really depends on how the file system is designed, because as we have been seeing through all the points, the topics that came up during the last 2 days of discussion is the performance of the file system can and certainly becomes bottleneck as the number of files grow. And so it's a good idea to start with a good design to anticipate what kind of load your DMF server is going to actually have over the next, I don't know, two or three, the production plan period, and then design your storage and your file system with that thing already in mind, so that you don't get hit with unexpected bottlenecks on your DMF server. And just a small part of that storage design is to do some of the tweaks that are standard storage design guidelines. Stripe alignment, so when you are making LUNs, you make them, I'm assuming the standard storage, LSI RAID storage, and then you design your RAID sets within your LSI RAID storage depending on what your design goal is. You're looking for high performance storage, or you're looking for high capacity storage, whether you have fiber channel disks or SATA disks. So these are some of the simple guidelines. The design of 4 plus 1 and 8 plus 1 RAID 5 or 4 plus 2 8 plus 2 RAID 6 is kind of a simple design that aligns naturally with buffer sizes that are used in the system. It also aligns naturally with the 2 MB transfer buffer that LSI controllers use. So if you use that design guidelines, then you will probably not hit as many transfer bottlenecks as you might on any other kind of design. Stripe alignment is very critical in making sure that you get proper write performance out of your storage. If your beginning of your writes are not aligned to the stripe boundaries, then you end up with two writes or multiple read modify writes on every time you do any write operation to the disk controller. And so you have to make sure that if you are designing your RAID storage manually, then you take care of aligning the stripe boundaries in the structure of your volume design. If you are doing a 2 raised to n kind of a RAID set design, so 4, 8, or powers of 2, then the stripe boundaries will naturally align with a 256K or a 512K or a 1 MB buffer boundaries. But if you are designing with a different size RAID set, if you're designing a 7 plus 1 or a 5 plus 1 or a 10 plus 1 RAID set, then you need to really do some calculation and make sure that your boundaries actually align there. And so a couple of examples and some helper scripts. Another factor that we need to consider is the behavior of LSI storage and how SGI softwares use that storage. So one of the properties that we are looking for in storage is the LSI property of automatic volume transfer. And we use this LSI feature to automate path failover on the server side so that if the end-to-end path, including the HPA in the server or the fiber channel cables or the switch ports or the LSI controller, any of these parts or these components fail, then we are automatically able to switch over to a new path and continue I/O to that particular LAN. And the AVT feature in LSI hardware is one that enables this behavior for us. But to use the AVT feature, there are some limitations. And one of the limitations is all the servers and all the HBAs and all the devices that are on the SAN, they actually ping the storage to find out what is actually happening, where is the LAN, what is the capacity, what are the addresses, and so on. And so anytime your server is doing I/O to a particular LAN and some other server comes up, you don't really want that server to change the path and ask the LSI controller to fail over ownership from one controller to the other controller just because that server has a path only going to the second controller. And that can happen in a big complex SAN. And so what LSI provides is sort of a exclusion zone at the beginning and end of the device that you create on the LSI RAID storage. So when you create a LAN on the LSI storage, the first 8 megabytes is reserved as a AVT exclusion zone, which means when you are looking up what's available on the SAN and the HBA is going to make a query to find out what this volume is, it's going to read the first few blocks on the LAN to figure out what this LAN is. And that block happens to be in that initial part, and access to the initial part does not initiate failover of the paths or failover of controller ownership. And so what you want to do is you want to leave that part alone for people to just access that part and not have your system file system data residing over that part. And so when you are creating XVM volumes on top of a LAN, and when you are creating, labeling the disk and doing partitioning and all, you need to leave this 8 MB partition, 8 MB piece of hardware alone at the beginning and at the end of the LAN. Now, we used to do this manually, and then the software is also designed. Some of the Nexus software that we had the scripts to actually automate this. And one of the scripts that the storage engineering group has provided that automates this process of taking care of avoiding the AVT area and also labeling, taking care of the GPT labeling and taking care of the XVM labeling. I can make this script available. We have been using this script in the field to set up, manually set up all the RAID storage devices, and so probably a lot of sites already have access to a copy of the script. So I can make that script available as well for download. So during creating this labeling and stripe and the partitions, we have to actually also take care of the stripe alignment as to what size the RAID set is and how many, what is the total number of blocks that are going to be used in that RAID set, and where should our data partition start so that we don't start in the middle of a stripe of 4 disks or 6 disks or whatever the number of disks in our RAID set are. So that's the utility. It's just simply called XVM make gpt.sh, and it takes a few parameters. One of the parameters that helps you align your data slice in the XVM volume to the stripe boundary is how many blocks are there in your stripe. And so it will take that number of blocks and automatically align the slice to start at a multiple of the stripe boundary. As an example of how that is to be used in practice, so if I have a sample RAID in my workshop, created a RAID set with 5 plus 1 RAID 5. So again, that's going to generate an odd kind of stripe unit. The default 128K stripe unit, so we are going to read, write 128K data from each disk in our RAID stripe. So the total number of blocks or number of Ks in the RAID stripe is 1280 blocks. And so all the alignment we want to do is on the basis of 1280 block stripe size. So everything should start at the correct stripe boundary and be multiples of that stripe unit so that we don't kind of have to do a read and then modify and then write back across two stripes for a single read and write, a single write mostly. So running the script, it will take your whatever LUN device is available and then it has options of creating multiple slices, and it automatically does the GPT labeling and XVM labeling for you. And it will finally create a XVM physical disk volume, and it will also slice that XVM physical disk volume into the number of slices you want. So here's the example. We haven't asked for any particular number of slices, so it takes the whole disk and just makes one single XVM slice in it and generates one XVM volume for use. And it is going to align that on the 1280 blocks boundary. So once it has worked on that particular LUN, this, if we look at the XVM layout of how the partitioning and labeling was done, this is what we see inside. label area, and here we are talking about the XVM label, starts at disk block number 35. So the initial 34 blocks are used by the GPT label. So that's the standard Linux GPT label that occupies the first 34, and then the XVM label starts. The XVM label occupies a certain number of blocks. That's usually variable. It doesn't really need a lot of space. But then we have this 8 megabytes of exclusion zone where we don't want any data to be put in that area. So we got to skip over that area anyway. So what the script does is it puts all that 8 megabyte into the XVM label itself. Because we need to actually read the XVM label from all the servers on the SAN to figure out who this LUN is, whether it is the XVM LUN or not, which server does it belong to, and all the information. But while reading the XVM information out of that area, we don't really want to start any ownership transfers. And so we put all that information in the AVT zone itself. And then the data area starts after the 8 megabytes of the exclusion zone. But then at that point, we don't really want to start the data area at the block zero of the logical disk, because we also want to ensure that the data area is stripe aligned. And we got an odd number of blocks in our stripe. And so we need to make the starting point of our data area a multiple of the stripe size that we had. So 8192 plus 768 gives us a multiple of, I think, about 7 stripes. And so we start our data area on a stripe-aligned boundary. And then the number of stripes are also a total full stripes within that particular slice. So we leave some blocks unused at the end. XVM new versions are also got this extra feature added into them. So if you're not using this script and you're doing all this process manually at some stage, then you can actually use a flag within the XVM command to ask it to align to whatever specific stripe width that you have got for your RAID block. And the good thing about having that align command is if you said, I want a 2,000 gigabyte slice, it will actually prompt you to say that this is not actually falling on even stripe boundaries, and it will suggest you the calculated even number of stripes that should be in that partition. And so it sort of helps you along in designing a proper stripe aligned complete slice. Because If you are only going to make one single slice out of the whole LUN, then you don't really care whether the data slice actually ends on a stripe boundary or not. But if you are going to make multiple small slices, the first slice you are taking care of by starting at a stripe boundary. What about the next slice and the third slice and the fifth slice? And so every slice, you want to make sure that it starts at an even stripe boundary. And the align command will help you make sure that any random block number that you decide that I want to start a slice from this block number onwards, it will tell you whether it is stripe aligned or not. And it will let you adjust to the next even number of stripes so that whatever random slice you are going to choose within your disk, it will always be stripe aligned. And your writes will be perfectly aligned to your underlying RAID structure. So that's just a bit of help on doing stripe-based designing. The stripe alignment is also carried over through the XVM volume design to the file system, because the XFS file system actually can read your stripe size if it is available to it through the XVM structure, and it can then internally decide how to do the buffer flushing from memory to disk. And if the stripe size is available, it will align the flushes on that stripe boundary. And so it's critical to make sure that the XVM volume top layer design actually reflects what your underlying stripe size is. You can make a XVM volume out of a complex structure. So you can have a single disk, a single hardware spindle, and use that as your file system, basis of your file system. You can base it on a concat of multiple disk spindles or multiple RAID LUNs, or you can have a stripe, or you can have even more complex structure where you have stripes and concats at one layer, and then you have concats at a higher layer, and so you can build more complex structures. And the stripe unit gets propagated through some command options. If you actually make a XVM volume which is based on a stripe design, then the XVM itself internally propagates the size of the stripe. So it gets automatically picked up by your make file system MKFS command. So you don't really have to worry about if you have designed your XVM volume with all the stripe information at the time of designing it and making it, then the file system will automatically pick up that information and plug it in. So when you make the file system, you run a XFS info command on the file system, it will show you that the file system is already aware of the underlying stripe size and how many stripes are there in your volume. Now, this particular volume I have created, it's a stripe. Does this thing work? Yeah. So it's a stripe volume. It is based on two slices, two XVM slices in a stripe. And the unit of stripe boundary is 1280 blocks. So when we are doing writing to individual stripes, we are going to write in multiples of 1280 blocks. And that information is picked up and transferred here. And so here you, in XFS info, you see stripe unit 160 blocks and stripe width 320 blocks. May look a bit confusing. The unit reporting here is the file system block size rather than the disk block. So it's 4K file system blocks it's talking about. So 160 file system blocks is 1290 disk blocks. And it's also telling us that we have got two elements in our stripe. So the total width of our stripe is 320 file system blocks. So for a stripe volume, all this information is directly propagated automatically into the XVM command. That doesn't really work if you have a single disk or a single LUN, or if you have concats, because there is no stripe to talk about. There is an underlying stripe below this layer, but it is not reflected in the structure of the volume. And so if you are working on non-striped volumes, then you have to actually manually make sure that you feed in this parameter so that your file system can then work efficiently on those boundaries. So I have another volume here, which is a concat of two slices. It's the same structure. I'm using the same 5+1 RAID LUN. So I got the same stripe size of 1280 blocks. But because I'm operating on a concat, there is no information passed on from the lowest level LUN to the highest level structure there. And so if I make a default volume out of it, then there is no information transferred to the file system layer as to what is the stripe boundary that we should do our buffer flushing on. And so if you are making volumes, if you are making file systems on a concat volume or a single LUN volume, you need to specify the stripe unit and the stripe width in your makefs command to transfer that information into the file system. So that's another unrelated point on sort of making more efficient file system. One more related item on the storage design. When you have a stripe design, then the idea is you're writing to all the legs of the stripe in parallel so that if you send one instruction to transfer so many bytes through a buffer, then parts of it are getting written in parallel to all the disks. If you have a concat design, then the simple idea is that they are all sort of in sequence. So in theory, you will fill up one disk first and then go to the second disk and then go to the third disk. That's the idea of a concat, that you are attaching it at the end of this current sequence and it will fill it up when the first piece is full. The XFS file system actually handles it in a slightly different logical manner. The XFS file system has another concept of allocation group, so that the whole space in your file system, whether it is stripe-based volume or a concat-based volume, it divides it into groups of blocks called allocation groups. And then it treats those groups of blocks as logical disk spindles. You can, as a very simplistic scenario. And then it can conceptually parallelize access into those silos depending on how many different I/O requests are coming in. So in theory, it will be able to actually, if you get 100 requests of doing 100 independent different file IOs, they can be spread around even if you have a concat below the volume. And so you might say, if I have a concat and if I have just written 100 gigabytes into a 1 terabyte concat of 1,000 gigabyte disks, is it only the first disk that is getting filled up and all the other 9 disks are empty? In practice, it may not be so. It depends on the I/O patterns that are coming in. If you're writing one file at a time, maybe the first disk is only getting I/O. If you're writing 100 files at a time, they are going to be spread over all parts of your file system. So there are some internal flags that you can use to actually increase the performance of a concat-based file system. So ideally, you might think, if it's a concat-based file system, I'm only able to do I/O to one disk spindle, so that's the throughput I'm going to get from this file system. But using some additional flags that are available inside, we can actually spread the I/O to more of the logical groups. So when you create a file system, depending on the size of the file system, XFS will divide it into so many logical bins. So in this case, we have a big file system. It's about, just looking at that number there, it's about a 30 terabyte file system. And the structure of the file system is 10 concats. And so logically, the file system is divided into 64 allocation groups. If I just write files sequentially into it, it might end up most of the files here first, and then here first, and then here first, and so on. If I have a file system where there may be hundreds of different users doing their own different IOs independent of each other, and I want to spread them over this whole physical structure, then I could probably use some helper along. And so we have an internal flag called agskip, which means the next file request should skip over that many allocation groups and go to that number allocation group after that. And so in this, if we have got 64 allocation groups and we have logically 10 LUNs in a concat, we could specify agskip value of 7, and then every file system, every file, the next file that is written will go to the 7th allocation group, and by just simple calculation, that's going to be the next disk. And the next file that is going to be written will again jump 7, and it will end up in the 3rd disk. And so if you know the structure of what your volume is, and if you know what kind of I/O pattern you are going to get, in some situations, you can actually tune a concat-based volume file system to sort of work like a stripe-based file system. The agskip is actually not a published flag. It's available. It's been there for a while. It's not in the man pages yet. So there is a request open to actually publish it and put some documentation on it. Okay, so that was about a few items on storage and disk tuning. Any questions, queries? Move on to tape drive tuning. It's not really tape drive tuning, but tape access tuning, sort of. We have been seeing in the last couple of days issues about reliability or problems or serviceability of tape drives and tape volumes. Now, a couple of releases ago, the DMF software team added a utility called TS Report. And TS Report uses logs collected from the TS driver. So SGI has its own tape driver, kernel driver that handles I/O to the tape devices, and we provide specific model tape support in that tape driver. And so the TS report looks at all the logs collected from the TS driver, and it generates stats based on those logs. And the information that gets collected from individual tape drives is status flags. So one of the reports, the first report that it generates using those logs is, has any tape drive flagged that it needs head cleaning status? And then you'll get a report saying this drive at that time raised a flag that it needs head cleaning done. This was actually implemented because a lot of tape libraries do not have an automatic head cleaning function, tape drive head cleaning function. That's one hardware limitation on the very different range of tape libraries that we support. And on the other hand, the tape loader software that we use in many sites, the Open Vault software, also does not have a tape cleaning function designed within it yet. And so the simple sort of system admin level helping script was to generate a nightly report from the tape driver logs to flag how many different tape drives have had head cleaning flag raised, so that system admin could manually load cleaning tapes and get the head cleaning job done the next day. So one of the nightly reports you get from the TS report is a daily drive report that you should get an email every morning, and that tells you how many tape drives have had a head cleaning flag raised. The other report looks at all the load unload I/O activity on individual tape drives and individual tape cartridges that got loaded and unloaded, and data written and data read during that individual operation. And then it generates a stat on those things. So I've just put out part of the stat. So the first few lines are from the headlining nightly email that LTO21 and then LTO2 raised headlining flags at that time. The other report is from a second email report that gets generated called TS report, and that generates these kind of information. So drive number so-and-so happens to be a LTO4 drive. At 169 gigabytes of reads, encountered 6 read corrections during that operation. It wrote 134 gigabytes. This is on a 24-hour basis, so it collects logs from the last 24 hours and generates stats from them. Write corrections, read plus write corrections per gigabytes, unloads and load operations, and how many cleaning flags were raised for it. There are a host of other stats also available that these reports are generated through a script, and the script has some standard flags in it. And there is a TS report man page available for the utility, and you can run your own modified TS report to get extra information out of it.
Sure. A couple of comments on that second one. At least our site, it's an extremely large report. At first glance, it seems to be full of trivia that contains a lot of data and no information. The real gem is the summary table, and it's at the very end.
Yes.
So if you ignore this report because it's full of bullshit, the last 1% is the gold.
And which is why that's the only one.
A particular example identifies the drives by their serial numbers, which is pretty useless. It's under-documented, but you can provide a table of conversions to drive names that you might use in OpenVault or the TMF that makes sense to humans.
It's a script, and as Peter said, there are lots of options available. Some of them are built in the script. And so you can actually modify your local script to get the report that you want rather than the default report there. One difference, though, the replacement of the drive logical name is for path name rather than the serial number. So this part of the report will still give you only serial number.
But the path name is that
long. Yeah. And it's completely illegible.
It relates to the PCI increases. Yeah. Sort of rubbish. But if you can figure out the conversions and it's not too hard, I think you've sorted out, you can put simple names like
drive. More readable names, the logical names that you normally use.
Manipulate script?
No, I manipulate the script, but I believe the script's been changed so that that's already in there.
This script?
A text file with one line per drive, equating the
This equates to that. So
correct. So, and that has been updated in the most recent release. So you should be running that release. That you provide a config file with a list of path names and drive names, and it plugs in the drive name instead of path name. So it makes it simple.
This config file that you
So why wouldn't, if you feel that there's a lot of rubbish in the script, why doesn't the script get modified to have just a summary flag so you only get the summary rather than getting all the rubbish? So if you want all the rubbish, you can have it, or you can ask it for a summary.
Yeah, well, I guess at the DMF team level, they decided on a set of flags that will be reported by default. And it's easy to just modify the script for your site tunable and just reduce the number of fields that get reported. A couple of fields that are more interesting sometimes, and you could modify your script to get that reported. There is a field called compression, and the drives do report how much compression is going on. So if you are writing 169 gigabyte, which is the real data, how much compression is going on when the driver actually puts it on the tape physically, and the compression report can tell you it's 200% compression or 150% compression and so on. So that could be very handy in some situations.
The reason I call that summary gold is that you can go to your drive supplier, Oracle in our case, IBM and other people's. Instead of saying, I think this drive is a bit dodgy, could you help
have a look at it, you can see that in the summary that shows that the error rate on that drive is 100 times the error rate on all the other drives, and there's no argument for that. They just want to replace the drive.
Yep. And of course, this is only half of the equation. For brevity, I have only taken out the drive report. So there is a similar tape report generated in that same email. So if you had 100 tape volumes utilized during the last 24 hours, that's where the junk comes from. You get a list of all those 100 tapes and whatever happened on those tapes. And you probably are not interested in knowing about what read corrections might have happened on a given tape. You are probably only interested in if there were hard errors on the tape. And so you could filter this, tweak the flags that are in the script to reduce the type of report that gets. And so you could change that. And so the drive is reporting what it saw during 24 hours. And subsequently, you will get a report of the tape volumes as to what happened with this volume. This volume got loaded twice or 200 times in the last 24 hours. And what happened with that volume? And also, it will report errors. So if you are hitting some kind of hard errors on a tape volume, that you will see all that reflected in this report with probably a few hundred lines of error messages. Yeah. So it's pretty useful nightly report that you get, and it's a good place to start looking at any tape-related problems, tape drive or tape volume. And bit of news or heads up on Spectralogic tape libraries. They haven't had a auto-cleaning feature for some time, and last year they actually implemented a auto-cleaning feature in the new firmware release. They have a firmware called BlueScale, and the BlueScale 10.6 onwards, they have an auto-cleaning feature implemented in the firmware. But to use that auto-cleaning feature, you actually need a special barcode on the tape container box. And that barcode entitles you to get a auto-cleaning license that you install in the library. And then you put that bar. It's actually a zero-price item, but it's something that you need to arrange separately. So you get the maintenance terapack. If you're buying cleaning tapes, you buy that special terapack with a special barcode that allows you a license for auto cleaning. And then you set it up in the library as a separate cleaning partition, and then the head cleaning will happen automatically. As and when the tape drive flags head cleaning required, the library will automatically run a cleaning tape through it and make sure it's clean. And then, instead of getting cleaning reports, you will get reports like this, that the drive flagged, I need air cleaning now, and after some time, generate another cleaning that I'm taking this flag down because something happened. Some head got clean. There have been, initially, there were some questions about how this automatic head cleaning interferes with what OpenVault or TMF or whoever else is actually controlling the library. How does it interfere with their operation or does not interfere with their operation? And the way it is explained to us is what, and I guess this is the same logic that applies to the IBM 3584 library, which already has the auto-cleaning feature, is the library, when it unloads a tape, at the time of unloading a tape, it looks at the head cleaning flag being put on by the tape drive. If the head cleaning flag has been put on by the tape drive during that operation, then it does not actually release the tape drive. It unloads the tape, doesn't tell anybody that the tape is unloaded. It automatically puts a cleaning tape in, finishes the head cleaning operation, and then only releases the tape. So the head cleaning operation is completely transparent to whatever software application you are running to actually control tape loading and unloading. So it should not interfere with the tape operations at all.
I'm interrupting it again. Is anyone else here use storage tape libraries? Okay. On the subject of tape cleaning, it's a severe gotcha with automatic cleaning and storage tech, SLA 500.
Yeah.
The controlling software is called SL Console, and it comes from Oracle these days. There's a configuration option in there that says whether you want auto cleaning on or off. The correct setting is off. If you turn it off, then auto cleaning will happen. If you turn it on, you will never get any auto cleaning. Your drives will grind up and cease to function. Apparently, setting it on tries to activate a feature in SL Console that has never been implemented, therefore doesn't. If you disable it, the automatic cleaning cycles the library firmware provides
still works.
So just watch out. If it's clear, leave it clear. Sorry, conversation.
No. All right. Another issue, and something that everyone has probably encountered, you might some days see, this is a drive report, but on the tape report you might see dozens of tape load and load operation happening on a particular tape. You're wondering what is happening in the library. And as we have seen, there are user behaviors or system behaviors or processes, the way the software runs or the way users recall their file system. Applications that read one file at a time and the file has to be recalled from the tape. And so depending on how the application is actually processing that file, you will end up with a lot of tape loading and loading, a lot of tape media shoeshining. And so here is a little snippet of what, if you are looking through the DMF logs, what you might see in a DMF log. This is a small snippet of a very long sequence of tape load unloads that happened in that site on that day. So within a 17-minute window, one tape got loaded seven times and obviously unloaded seven times. And the actual I/O activity was within that 17-minute window was to recall 50 files. And when we looked at the details of what the activity was going on, all of these files were very small files, under a megabyte each. They were all within one single tape zone, so they were very close to each other physically on the tape.
Just a smaller question, Ted, is that in the DMF manager?
This is in the DMF logs, standard logs.
Yeah, is it in the visualization of the DMF manager?
I'm not sure if it is.
DMF manager, you mean?
Yeah, so
GUI, the interface.
The GUI?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
No. Looking at picking up information log, this is not yet implemented as any. It still has to be manually scripted. So we were looking at just working out what was happening that day, and this is some of the trace collected. So this is a small part of the whole sequence, and we figured out that these were all files very close to each other, and what was happening is, obviously it was either an application which was reading one file, processing it, then reading the next, or it could have been just a simple CP command or a rsync command, and they're just sequentially processing the files. Now, as has been discussed by many people, one part of it is educating the user community, providing tools like DMGET wrapper, and sort of avoiding this problem happening from in the beginning itself. But within DMF configuration itself, there are a couple of tweaks that are available that you can use to sort of provide a bit of help in this situation. So that was a snippet out of the main log, and then we went actually into the data mover log and looked at the detail of what was actually happening with each of those mount requests, and this is what we actually see happening on it. The way DMF read child operation works is when a request comes, a read child is started, the read child requests for a tape mount, and then it positions itself at whatever block is the file that is requested to be read. After the file is read, then it waits for 2 seconds. After reading the file, it stops there, the heads park themselves for 2 seconds. If there is no other activity requested, then the tape rewinds to the beginning. And if there is no further activity on that particular tape cartridge, then the tape gets unmounted. So this is what we see in the log actually happening during that time. So this is a log of just that one mount cycle that happened at 1431. So the first request after some time, I guess, hits, and a new DM80 RC write child process gets started at 1431.20, asks a tape to be mounted, takes so many seconds to get the tape mounted, and then the file is queued for getting read, so it positions itself. The file, as you will see at the end of the reading report, is only 130K long file, so it probably takes half a millisecond to read that file, but it takes it 4 seconds to actually position to the block and start reading. So after the file is read, the next request hasn't come, so the tape is parked and waiting there, waits for about 2 seconds, no new request, so ask it to be rewound. Goes back to the beginning of tape, and then almost at the mark of 2 seconds, it gets hit with the next request. So goes back, goes forward again. And so it goes through that kind of process multiple times. Reads the second file, waits for some time, no new request. In this case, it gets another request. So you can see the difference between going back, rewinding, and coming back takes it 11 seconds. If it had a second request happen within the short period itself, then the two requests get serviced within milliseconds of each other because they are just next to each other on the tape. And so it goes through this sequence a few times, and then eventually the request, the next read request after that is actually a few more seconds late, and so that read child times out, and after 2 seconds rewind and 5 seconds waiting at the BOT, it just unmounts the tape.
Sir, is there a read ahead cache or something along those lines that could help with this sort of process? Can you basically say cache a certain amount when you get hit with a read off the tape and then throw it away after X amount of time?
The read child is getting passed one request at a time, so it's only going to read that file and say, my job is done. Yeah. It doesn't know where the next request is going to be. It could be the next file, it could be some other file, or there could be no other request. So it doesn't really read anything more than it is asked to do. But it does provide this option of, if you really wanted to read the next file, I'm waiting here. And so DMF provides you a couple of flags to tweak these numbers. So that's what we do. We can actually set these two flags. The first flag is rewind delay. So there is a 2 second default rewind delay. And so if you know that this is what is going to happen normally in your system, that people are running this kind of jobs, you can say, well, don't rewind this tape in 2 seconds, maybe wait there for 10 seconds. And the second flag is read idle delay, which means if you have rewound after 2 seconds or whatever else you had put in there, don't unmount the tape for a few more seconds. Maybe there is another request coming in. So we don't want to go to the expense of spending half a minute unmounting and then half a minute remounting the tape. And so you could tweak these two numbers and sort of reduce a lot of wear and tear and shoe shining and mount and unmount cycles on your tape library. And the good thing about it is these two flags are non-binding. So if you did say that, please rewind this tape but wait there for 30 seconds, and if an unrelated request comes in that requires a different tape to be mounted, then the daemon will decide that I have a more higher priority request, and so I don't want to wait 30 seconds for this tape. I will unmount it straight away and mount the next tape. So these are non-binding, and so depending on how you see the patterns in your backend on your DMF server taking place, you can always jack up these numbers to sort of more manageable numbers.
There's also a similar parameter when you're writing to a tape. When it runs out of data to write, it sits there at the end of the tape for a few seconds just in case something more comes along.
How's it handling the tape driver scenario where rather than mounting, it goes to another tape driver and uses that to mount the next tape?
It can, because it's got access to multiple tape drives. So it has its own internal priority table as to what is the priority of the request coming in. If there is a different tape drive available and free, it might say, I will leave this drive alone and I'll mount the fresh tape onto that tape drive. But if this is the only tape drive available and it is just waiting there because we set a flag of 30 seconds, then it will get booted off.
I would have thought that the tape needed to spin up to speed before you could read it in some fashion. Does this mean that it's actually moving relatively slowly and reading it at that rate? You know, so it can't just stop and read the next thing. Or does it have to get back and forth anyway?
It depends on where the data being read is. So if you pass it a queue of, say, 10 files, and the files happen to be sequentially, physically after one another, then it will read them at streaming rate. If they happen to be in different locations on the tape, it will finish reading one file, reposition itself on the different starting block, read that file, reposition itself.
Does that actually mean repositioning on the other block going past it and spinning past it to read it? It could.
The tape technologies have been changing. Let me draw a little picture here. Is that a... The black one will look good. The tape media is so many meters long. It's a linear medium, let's say 500 meters. The tape head is actually an assembly of multiple heads. So the tape head has got about 16 heads in it. And then the tape has something called serpentine tracks. So there is a track like this, and then there is a track like this, and then one here, and one here, and one here, one here. And so when this head is moving, it can do a sort of a random access within this limit. So if it is reading this track here, and now it has to read this track here, it doesn't have to go through that sequence. It can actually jump from here to here. So to that extent, even the tape is random access.
But if it gets to a place, does it have to back up a little bit to get speed to read it back again?
No.
Not anymore.
Yeah. So when it finishes reading the file, it's parked itself on the file mark. And when it gets the address of the next block, it jumps to that address. So that motion is just straight head relocation. And the way these things work out, you will see, if you're actually monitoring how long it takes to access one file and the next file and the next file, you can actually see this pattern, that after a certain number of files, if you jump to the next file, it might not take that much time because the next file is actually here at the beginning of the tape, but on a different track. Okay, I think that was about it for me.
Brilliant.
Done.